Welcome to Pushback, a social justice podcast produced and distributed by Philadelphia Magazine and Word Radio.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? This is Flood the Drummer.
And Malcolm Burnley.
And welcome to a special conversation with Asa Khalif regarding the face of a movement. But before we get to that, Malcolm, you know, last podcast we did, we talked about the autobiography of Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. And I think that he is probably one of the most readied personalities that come to mind when you think about the face of a movement and then how that caused tension, right? I mean, if you think about the way that celebrity kind of intrudes upon solidarity, I think he's a good story, right?
Right, because, I mean, part of his story was that as he became more and more popular, it was also his, I guess, thoughts were changing, but there's a schism within the Nation of Islam. That was part of it, at least, that people were maybe afraid that he was becoming too powerful or that his celebrity was would basically wield too much influence. And so there was efforts to, rein him in, and then eventually also his ideology shifted somewhat, but it in part caused him to break away from the Nation of Islam by the end of his life and form his own organization.
Is there any other civil rights leaders or personalities that you know of throughout history that kind of had that same tension? I think Martin Luther King, I mean, I don't know if it was as public as Malcolm X's was, but I have to imagine that there were some people who were around with Dr. King. I mean, if you look at it, you know, if you look at it post Dr. King's death, you hear now stories of people who say, well, we were there too, you know,
right,
and
right.
You kind of have that tension. I remember when Selma came out, I had a chance to interview Ava DuVernay, who directed that. She talked about how he didn't do it by himself, right? There was Byron Rustin, there was... when you look at the movie, there was a group of people he traveled with, but history only seemed to remember one person.
Well, I think it's just kind of how we tell history, right? At least in this country, which I think there's always this tension there, that we do tend to look at the individual. We usually tell stories through, you know, the hero or in that case, the hero or the villain, right? And I think we raise up individuals, and sometimes it's easier, right? I mean, to affiliate or to, I guess, relate to a movement, to relate to one person or to listen to one person's message, as opposed to, I guess, a crowd. So I think that's kind of inherent just at celebrity in America, and that's no different from athletes to civil rights movement, you know. Certain individuals, Michael Jordan,
but it doesn't cause the same type of tension, right? In sports as it does activism. I mean, I think there's
more at stake in activism. I think it probably happens throughout anything.
But
right?
There's do you have an expectation that there's going to be stardom in sports and in the,
oh,
the private sector?
Saying.
You know what I mean? Whereas in civil rights, you're just kind of expecting solidarity. But it's not even new within this Black Lives Matter space. DeRay McKesson got the same type of heat, if you will, in 2015, right? 2016, when Freddie Gray, when all that happened, he was the one that was on MSNBC, and you had people on Twitter. You had even the people who founded Black Lives Matter almost distancing himself from him, particularly when he decided he wanted to run for mayor of Baltimore.
Right.
Same thing
as
with
a
Sean
Democrat,
King, yeah. Democrat. But the same thing with Sean King, the New York Daily News. And it seems like once somebody is elevated to the point where it seems that the others are relegated to the shadows, that's where the tension happens.
So, should we get into background? No, background into. In part the backdrop to Asa coming on. So part of the reason why we're bringing Asa on, Asa is obviously a really well-known face, organizer, activist in the Philadelphia community, and also nationally. I would say he has a national profile to a degree. So I think there's a lot of interest in him, and also, you know, in him being right or wrong, somewhat of a celebrity of Black Lives Matter movement, at least within Philadelphia. But then the more recent, I guess, backdrop is that celebrity has caused some tension or also some confusion in the media. And so recently this started with an article in Breitbart, which is a right-wing news outlet online, and mentioning Asa in the context of a Black Lives Matter space within Philadelphia that was a Black-only space. And there was all kinds of mischaracterizations. I mean, number one, Asa wasn't necessarily affiliated with this specific group. It was also, you know, the mischaracterization of a Black-only space and what that's actually about. But anyways, it's caused him some friction, both within the activist community locally, and it's also caused blowback from everyone from the left to the right. So we want to really kind of dig in, I guess, into both the positives and the negatives, the burdens and the privilege of being a face of a movement.
I think that's a perfect way of saying it, the burdens and the privilege of being a face of a movement. So without further ado, Asa Khalif, welcome to Pushback.
Welcome. Thank you very much, Flood the Drummer. Thank you, Malcolm. Peace and blessings to all who's listening.
So I guess the first thing was just, you know, address the elephant in the room.
I don't think the elephant is already shitted and gone at this point.
You're now Black Lives Matter Movement, Pennsylvania chapter.
That's correct.
And that was a result of the controversy and the confusion that some said was existing between you and Black Lives Matter Philadelphia, which is an actual sanctioned chapter of Black Lives Matter, right?
Yes.
Just so we can get it out the way, tell me the difference between what you're doing in Black Lives Matter Movement of Pennsylvania and what's happening with Black Lives Matter Philly. Well,
to deal with the name, Black Lives Matter Pennsylvania, when we were operating under that, these were individuals in the group that was a part of the movement, and some that were actually part of some network chapters, who decided that they needed a louder voice here in Philadelphia, and we needed more direct action. So we decided those who were in the movement, the difference between the two were Black Lives Matter Philly is a part of the network, the national 13.
So it's like
chapters.
Having an NAACP chapter.
Exactly.
It's a sanctioned
right.
chapter.
But there's 13 chapters under the original three black queer women who started the hashtag and then led to the movement. And those who of us who are in the movement are more organizing more locally, nationally, internationally. You have the D-Ray McKessons, Sean King, and Janetta, so on and so on. So it gives more.
You put yourself in the class with those guys?
You know, I never really, even before I became a part of the movement, I never liked putting myself as someone that's a leader. I've always, you've never heard that come out of my mouth. That's usually something that the media came up with or the people, you know, in the neighborhood. I've always been someone who was very passionate. I saw an injustice and I wanted to speak on it. And I think we all have a leadership role, whether we're writing about it or we're in the streets or we're behind the scenes or whatever. We all have a leadership role to play in terms of fighting anti-blackness. But, you know, I've never said that I was a leader. If someone else or the media, portrays me that's out of my control.
So I think I remember one of the earliest, maybe not the earliest conversations I remember bubbling up about Black Lives Matter, but I think this was before people really had a conception of what it was whether this was going to be a quote unquote leaderless movement. There's this whole debate about leaderless movement or, I think people were saying it was a leaderful movement. However you wanted to, the idea was that it might be organic. It might grow organically. And that was kind of one of the both advantages and what got people excited about Black Lives Matter.
Absolutely.
I was wondering, if your thoughts on that have changed at all. And also, given that you have become, or at least considered somewhat of a leader now, and I know you said maybe you don't use that term, but people use that term to apply to you. Is there an advantage to having faces to Black Lives Matter, to having a few leaders that are well known? Is there an advantage to that?
Well, there's always an advantage if it gets you to the table when you can actually sit down with your demands to help your community. It doesn't matter if it's you or Flood or whoever. If that becomes the contact person to help individuals who are without heat, or help someone in that's facing homelessness, or someone that needs in the community that's dealing with abuse. Whatever point of contact person is an advantage for us. The whole point of protesting, the whole point of shutting things down is not just to, you know, get your name in the papers. Beyond all that, the point is to get eventually to get to the table to make those changes. You cannot make changes unless you're at the table. If you're not at the table, then you know you're out in the cold pretty much with a sign. The sign gets you in to those meetings where you can actually make fundamental change for your community and have a list of demands that you can articulate and that you can negotiate. So that's why I do it. The end game for us, or for me personally, is to be at that table to let you know about Mrs. Jenkins, to let you know about Mrs. Taylor, to let you know about the brother that's coming out of the prison system and needs housing, needs Medicare, needs ID, need to get back to those resources to get him back so he can stay out of it. That's the only for us. It's never for some celebrity. Believe me, this is not, if you're looking to be a celebrity in under this movement, you're really in the wrong movement in terms of social justice, because there is, the end game is always, your life is constantly threatened.
But celebrity is there, and you are a celebrity, right?
Celebrity, I'm Chris is making me laugh, but that's my
you're not
I'm your brother.
So you're not going to accept
I'm your
the term,
brother. I'm not going to accept.
You're not going to accept the term celebrity. And you're not going to accept the term leader.
No.
So then, how do you
not.
See yourself?
I see myself as a passionate black man who realizes that there's a gap in terms of here in Philadelphia that I see, and I want to fill that gap.
So, celebrity is being imposed on you?
I believe so. Mm. I believe so. Yes.
And it's being leveraged, too, I mean, I guess is what you're saying, too. I mean, there are, like we talked about, there are advantages,
Yeah, of course. And the advantages is not for me. The advantages is for the community that I represent. We kept this last week, and I was telling Chris about it, we kept two families in their homes who were facing eviction, right? I'm talking about hours. While people were tweeting and posting and all that other nonsense, we were out there negotiating with the landlord. The only reason why the landlord was so flexible was because I got on the phone and they were familiar with me, and I promised them, they had my word, by 5 o'clock they would have their money if you let this family stay in the house. So yes, if that was some sort of celebrity to use as an advantage to help, then yeah, I use that to help the community.
The last piece about celebrity before we kind of, I know we're going to have a larger conversation, but. Mm-hmm. I think we just have to seal up this whole chapter movement thing and the whole confusion thing. You do concede that there's confusion in the market, right? You understand that, and that was the reason for the name change.
Well, we have been operating under Black Lives Matter Pennsylvania for a year and a few months. There was never any confusion in the neighborhood. People knew exactly who to go to if they wanted change or if they wanted their needs met. They knew the difference between Philly. They knew the difference between us. It was never, when you reach the wrong chapter, you need to go here. People wanted things done. Mm-hmm. And this is from the community. Mm-hmm. They knew to contact me, and they knew to contact Black Lives Matter Pennsylvania. We get things done. We don't have the time for the nonsense. We have to deal with anti-blackness, and we have to deal with uplifting the pain and agony in our community that our elders are facing. We're about the work. As you well know, we are about the work. There was no confusion.
Why not just change the name completely? Why do Black Lives Matter movement?
Because we are Black Lives Matter activists. We have put our bodies on the line. We're not going to diminish ourselves simply because other people have a problem with that. We have been putting our bodies on the line, men and women that's a part of this group, on a national level. You understand? So, you know, it's unfair. Okay, because other folks want to be larger to make us smaller. That's not right. You understand? If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, is a duck. Okay, we're not going to say, we're not going to be doing the work of Black Lives Matter and then say that we're, NAACP. Because we're not working under NAACP. We're not getting arrested under NAACP. We're not getting punched in the face by pig cops under NAACP. We're doing it because we are part of the movement of Black Lives Matter.
So we talked about some of the advantages to celebrity, but there's obviously obvious downsides. And, recently we got into it in the introduction, but not only was your name, bandied about in Breitbart, but mm-hmm. then there was, local columns, several local columns, both referring to you and this, for lack of a better word, controversy. So, this is an intimate conversation. Share with our listeners a little bit of the downside that's been happening to you recently. All the what's been the negative attention that you've been getting, and how has that affected you personally?
Well, I'm going to say this because a lot of people are not aware. First of all, when the article dropped, my name was mentioned specifically, okay? That's the only reason why I responded, because to us, it was a Black Lives Matter Philly, and they were very capable of defending themselves. We personally wouldn't even address it.
You're talking about the Breitbart article.
I'm talking about the Breitbart article. We would not have addressed it, period, because our allies know what time it is with us because we've had those conversations. The only reason why I had to get involved was because my name and my image was being used, and I had to correct that. And I had an 80-year-old Polish woman in Massachusetts who is my loving grandmother. For those who know, I'm adopted. My father is Polish-American, but I had my grandmother, 6 o'clock in the morning, calling me, crying, thinking that somehow or another I had changed my way of thinking and she was not welcome in my presence. And I still get choked up about it, but it angered me that I was having those conversations. In the meantime, after calming her down, mind you, my day hasn't even started. I'm getting inbox messages from certain groups that's saying that, you know, you're an opportunist, you're this, you're that, why did you, you know, and so on top of all that, and I still had to do Solomon Jones' show and still make sure.
And they, just to be clear, they called you an opportunist because you responded to the article.
Exactly. But I responded to an article that mentioned my name and used my image. And that was what I was responding to.
And other groups you're talking about, like other groups within the movement calling you an opportunist?
Well, I shouldn't say groups. I should say certain individuals who are attached to certain groups. And it's a small number, believe me. And they have attacked many people, not just me. So, I'm not, oh, woe is me. They have attacked many people from high to low because that's what they do. And haters need to have a target. They need someone to vent and to lash out when there's no peace and no joy and no solitude in their hearts.
But it's also jealousy, right?
Yes, of course. And jealousy, as the scripture says, is crueler than the grave. You know, you can't. Jealousy will make someone kill you. People have been murdered because of jealousy. Malcolm is a prime example. Well, that started with a seed of jealousy that was watered and festered, and then it exploded, and that was the end result. So it's very dangerous when people are harboring that type of hate. Not only is it dangerous for themselves physically and spiritually, but it's dangerous for you. This is a world where Donald Trump, for God's sakes, was elected president. I am not above being shot or hurt or injured because of people's jealousy. And it's sad when you're getting, even if it's a small amount of group of people, you're getting it from your own people. We face too much anti-blackness to be making those type of threats on Facebook and Twitter.
And then you've been getting it from both sides, right? I mean, not
yes,
only
I
people
have.
In the movement, but then you've also been getting threats from, you
I've
know.
Received a threat today. We've been receiving threats all week long, ever since this thing had dropped. It's now be revealed on Twitter or whatever it was posted that I live in Old City. Now they know where I live at. You know, it was under the impression I lived somewhere in Center City. They didn't know where, but now they know. And they know it's 2nd Street. I can't say it because it's out there now. We had to have people today, two bodyguards to watch out for my mother as she goes to work in Center City. We had to make preparations for immediate family, you know, my sister, myself. You know, this is all as a result of a racist conservative blog, and it really doesn't help when instead of coming together in solidarity, we're allowing certain
people to
hate. Well,
I mean,
that's
a little unfair to blame a blog for all of that's happening.
What I'm saying, the blog starts... I'm talking about the hate on that part. Oh, whites are not welcome. To start the instigating that to bring out the crazies on their side. You know, we're talking about two different issues now. We're talking about a blog to incite that side. And then we're talking about something that unfortunately has plagued Black liberation all for generations. And that is, you know, a group of jealousy, unfortunately.
Tell us about your past.
Well, my first protest was at 26 in Oxford, 13 years old. There was a corner store selling loose cigarettes. and corn liquor on the side. And people would go there and
I say corn liquor?
Corn liquor.
Just want to clarify
and,
for
yeah,
the audience.
Corn liquor. And that's the first time I even heard about corn liquor. I was like, we're going to get corn. I'm thinking candy corn. And people are coming in and, saying, and coming out lolly. I'm like, my friend, I'm like, yo, I got to get some of this corn. What is going on? And they were selling corn. They were selling corn liquor. And so it was, I felt in my heart again that it was not cool. And I felt that in other neighborhoods, and in fact, I know in other neighborhoods, they were not serving doing this type of situation. So, and plus they were rude and you could feel the anti-blackness even at a young age. And I felt that this needed to be addressed. And so we organized and what started out basically, I thought 10, if we got 10 people out there, it would be cool. The neighborhood came out, and I think it was about 60, 70 people came out. The store was eventually shut down and became a black, was bought by a local resident in the neighborhood and became a black owned store.
So they weren't selling, just to make sure I understand the story. So they weren't selling to black customers? That was the issue?
No, they were selling junk to black customers
underage. Got it.
And that was a problem.
It was causing problems in the
community. It was causing a problem personally for me. Those who were indulging in it, they were happy to get the corn. But I felt for me that this was very destructive, even at a young age. And it definitely was very anti-black. Mm. And it needed to be addressed. That's just the passion that I had. And we organized that. So that was my first big 13, yeah, was the first.
So who are some of your early mentors and what impact did they have on your life and how are they influencing what you're doing today?
Sister Sakari Rose was definitely one.
And for our listeners who that may not know who
she is. Sister Sakari Rose is a legendary activist, a strong black woman, a very passionate black woman, loving black woman, and she organized against anti-blackness long before Black Lives Matter came in Philadelphia. She also spearheaded the black men and women have a right to work on these construction sites. Excuse me, there were a lot of construction going on in Philadelphia, North Philadelphia, and South Philadelphia in our neighborhoods, and we were not black men were not allowed to work on those sites and black women, and so Sister Sakari said if they don't work, if we can't work, they won't work. And this was, again, at a very young age, sitting, learning, letting black women or black woman lead me and respecting that. So that's why when the word misogynistic comes up, I'm like, I don't know what the hell that is. Not applied to me. But she was definitely one. Sister C. Dolores Tucker. Mm-hmm. I remember bringing me into her office and encouraging me, helping me with my first protest and how to strategize and how to organize. Of course, my dear mentor, Jerry Mondesire, who told me.
He's a former president of the NAACP.
Former president of NAACP.
Big guy, wore the cowboy hat.
Yeah.
People who might not remember or remember him. But
and was larger in life, just like that cowboy hat.
Yeah.
But he.
He was a tough guy.
He was a very tough guy, but he brought me to that table at a young age, and told me to take notes. Mm. And I kept my mouth closed and took notes, and he taught me a lot.
How did your parents, your adoptive parents, who you consider your parents, I shouldn't say adoptive.
No, my mother married a Polish white man.
Right.
And he became my father.
Right.
He's the only father I've ever known.
How do you think that impacted your understanding of race, having a white father?
My dad knew that no matter how much money he had, it was not going to protect me from anti-blackness. He knew that he was raising a black son, and so we couldn't get around it. We couldn't pussyfoot around it. We had to deal with it directly, and my dad is very direct, and we dealt with it. How to handle the police. We had those talks, you know. You're going to be driving my car. You're going to be stopped. What do you do? You know, I'm white. I know how white folks think. This is the strategy you use when you're in a room with white folk. Mm. You know, I'm going to be a traitor to my race because you're my son and I love you. And that's what he said.
Your dad's also, I would say, one of your biggest fans, right?
Yes,
I mean,
he
I've
is.
Met him several times.
Absolutely.
He comes to some of the protests. He was there when you put the hood on Frank Rizzo.
Yes, he was. But see, when my dad had marched with me when I couldn't get two people to come out. My dad was there. You know, they was like, who's that crazy white dude? You know, he's been my biggest fan. My mother, too. Mm-hmm. I just had prayer with my mother. They've been my biggest fans, my biggest supporters, my whole family, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm so blessed because we have, you know, black, white, we have Asian in our family, we have people in the LGBT community in our family. And my uncle is a legendary gay rights activist mm-hmm. in here locally in Philadelphia. You know, so I've had all of those support systems to kind of help me navigate through this. Like when they were really attacking me and I was on the phone with Flood, we were really attacking. My family just popped up,
mm-hmm.
and they had macaroni and cheese, dinner, I didn't call them, but they felt that spirit of heaviness that was on me, and I was heavy. You know, there's very few people I can talk to. You know, my brother, thank God. You know, vice versa, if he needs me, we talk. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you need that mm-hmm. connection with your family. You know, you need that big mama. Mm. And that soul food love connection.
While we talk about family, we can't go in this conversation without talking about Brandon Tate Brown, your
yes.
cousin.
Yes.
I mean, you never really got a chance to grieve. We talked, I think, the day after Brandon was killed. You yes. were nonstop protesting. Have you had a chance to grieve yet? And has your family been there to support? How has your family assisted in that grieving process?
And then if you could just start off by telling, again, for the people who don't know, Brandon Tate Brown, you know, it's obviously a famous example in Philadelphia.
Well, Brandon was murdered December 15th, 2 years ago, by the Philadelphia police, shot by officer.
This is 2014, December 14, 2014. So almost 3 years.
Yeah, 3 years.
Wow. God, I can't believe it's been 3 years.
Hang Dang and Nicholas Corelli.
These were two rookie police officers
who should not have been.
That's a part of the story that doesn't get talked about a lot. That's
right.
Proper protocol.
Well, no, you pair the rookie up with a seasoned officer. And Brandon was coming home legally driving a rental car that his employer gave him for the weekend. So there was nothing wrong with the paperwork, nothing shady about the paperwork. And driving black. Mm-hmm. Pulled them over and said that, oh, your lights were low, your lights were dim. And, of course, dealing with police, it escalated and wound up with his brains on the floor, on the ground. Of course, they moved the body, which was not in protocol.
But just back up. The original story was that he was reaching into a car for a gun, and that's mm-hmm. why they shot him.
Yes.
Right. But later it came out.
It came.
That's not true. He was actually running away when he was unarmed.
Exactly. And it took a lot of protests, a lot of arrests, one big dramatic brawl, just to get the names. And that's the thing that's outrageous about it. You know, before you even ask for dismissal or lawsuits or any of that, just to get the names of the police officers, we had to go through all that. And it really showed that black lives really don't matter when it comes to law enforcement, and it really doesn't matter when it comes here in Philadelphia.
Mm.
So, you know, before it was a hashtag, we've been fighting black lives for black lives all our lives, just being black, just being biracial, just, you know, if you can't pass, Black Lives Matter. Mm. It's going to present itself to you. It's going to force you to become an advocate for yourself first. So, yeah. It's in civil case or whatever it is to deal with it at this point. But I hadn't grieved. I was in the studios about to tape a segment on Stop and Frisk
mm-hmm.
when I got the call, you know, that Brandon was murdered. And our family found out that he was dead on Channel 6.
Mm-hmm.
That's how disrespectful this rotten system was. And how disrespectful the district attorney's office was.
They continued to be pretty disrespectful to your family after that.
They
eventually apologized.
They've apologized eventually, you know, but at this point, you know, whatever, you know. But it showed that Tanya, and God bless my cousin.
Tanya Brown Dickinson
is the
mother.
Tanya Brown Dickinson, the mother, Brandon. It brought something out of her,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Something she wanted to come out.
Something that she didn't know she had. My point is I had to hold the family together. My family didn't know anything, that side of the family mm-hmm. didn't know anything about activism, didn't know anything about who to call, who mm-hmm. to connect. I couldn't grieve for Brandon. When I left New York and came to Philadelphia, I went straight to the house and started making calls. At that point, a certain group backed out, okay? And I won't say the name because they redeemed themselves, but it was just me. And I was operating still under racial unity. At the point, I was still president of Racial Unity USA. So all the contacts, I had to start moving, bringing investigators in that we worked for in the past, bringing reporters in that I trust that will get it right, calling Flood, saying, look, you got to drop all this. This is, you need to get here. We need a spokesperson. Calling our contacts in local media. The point is, I didn't have chance to grieve because everyone was grieving on my shoulders, and I needed to stay strong to keep them moving. Now it's a little different. I can finally grieve. I saw a wonderful play by Mr. Keith Wallace.
Keith Wallace.
The Bitter Game. And shout out to Keith, who mentioned my cousin Brandon's name.
In a very powerful segment.
In a very powerful scene. And I was able to finally grieve without feeling like I need to go behind the scenes and cry. I'm able to express that emotion at this point and feel very comfortable doing it. But
I think people might pause this podcast here and go, Asa Khalif's cries?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because I think to a lot of people, you're just this really angry caricature who just says, fuck the police and just to shut shit down. But well, you have feelings.
Well, I think at Philly Fest or Think Fest, I think people saw another side also that we were able to sit down and articulate. Still the same passion, but not the imagery that they see in terms of protest. We can have a conversation right here without me, you know, using a bullhorn. And then when you're in a protest like that and you're face-to-face with your oppressor, it does bring up a different side because you're calling on your ancestors for justice and strength and courage. So it's different. But, you know, it's still fighting anti-blackness no matter how the volumes are up and down.
I think that's a really interesting point about kind of like the public versus private. What are some of the other ways, I guess, in private that you have to, I guess, sustain yourself or to keep up the, I guess, this energy that you expend in public?
It's my spirituality. I did a fast and cleanse last night at 12 o'clock to prepare for this space. And so, yeah, the spiritual aspect really helps you. And I say many times, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against spiritual wickedness in high places. So it's a spirit. When people don't wake up one morning just hating. There's something that brought them to that point. It's a spirit of hate, and it festers and it grows. Racism is a spirit of hate and ignorance. And so you need to, because it'll consume you. You go home and you're drained and you don't want to become like your oppressor. You don't want to start hating like them. You don't want to become the hate that hate or that it produced. So you really need to separate yourself. That's why it's important to have solid friends. Not no new friends. I don't make new friends. I have solid friends. My friends that I have from high school, from grade school, you know. So it's important to surround yourself with positive people that you can trust and know that they love you and they have your best interests at heart. I wouldn't have been able to do it if it wasn't. It has affected some of my relationships on a personal level. It really damaged my relationship of 8 years, my ex. I have to take responsibility for that because it was all about the movement and not about realizing that I have to go home and that I have a personal life as well.
It's a sacrifice.
It is a very sacrifice, but you have to be able to realize the balance, see, and be able to navigate. You know, if you don't navigate, it's a problem. You wake up in the morning before you eat your Cheerios saying, fuck the police. Something's a problem. There's a problem.
At least for a while, I felt like maybe the media locally in Philly wasn't not only not talking about Black Lives Matter that much, but I felt like, for example, Brandon Tate Brown didn't really get elevated on a national stage as some of the other murders did?
Well, after the fight in Longcrest, it became national. They started saying Brandon Tate Brown's name nationally on NBC Tonight News, World News Tonight. And then PBS took it nationally, and then it it led to Tanya even being reached out by Hillary Clinton and so on. So it did go national. I know what you're saying, though, like the Mike Browns and so on and Eric Gardner.
Yeah.
But we were able, in our own small way, with other activists, and I will never not acknowledge there were activists, even those who I'm at odds with at this point, but they stood with the family when other mainstream activists and organizations did not at that point.
I want to talk about the DA's race. We've mentioned the DA in various incidents over the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
So the first question I have about the DA's race, which for people who aren't initiated into it, is a pretty wide open race. What people have been describing as maybe one of the most wide open DA's primaries in recent history. And we all know in Philadelphia, the primary is essentially everything. So my first question is, you've come and supported Larry Krasner, who is a candidate for DA.
Yes.
Getting back to kind of this whole differences between, you know, some of the Black Lives Matter movements nationally versus, yourself, a Black Lives Matter, self-labeled Black Lives Matter activist. It's a position of some that they're not endorsing political candidates. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know, why did you come out and support Larry Krasner and, I guess, break from, you know, somewhat of a tradition in black liberation groups, but black centric groups to not endorse candidates?
Well, the Black Lives Matter movement, Pennsylvania, do not endorse candidates. This is me as an activist individually endorsing Larry because I know Larry personally. I know Larry has put himself on the line pro bono to do work for Black Lives Matter activists, for those who are part of the network and the movement, not to mention his long history of supporting activists from ACT UP to Occupy and so on and so on, even individual activists.
And so just to full circle, he represented to the Philly 10, right?
I mean, he did represent the Philly 10. We're part of the Philly 10. And I want to make in terms of white allies, there were white allies who were in that brawl and was arrested as well.
Mm-hmm.
We had white allies who lost their job by standing with us in that brawl. And so Larry, along with Michael Cord,
mm-hmm.
Represented us. And Larry's been representing me as a Black Lives Matter activist since then. His record, people ask you, why are you endorsing a white candidate? I'm endorsing the only thing that's different between, that's black and white about Larry Krasner is his record. And you can look at the record. You can be black and be anti-black. We've had two terms of anti-blackness from the district attorney's office. So don't give me that black, he black bullshit because, where were you? Any of the candidates, but don't give me that black candidate crap when I didn't see you at the Tamayo McDuffie. I didn't see any of these black candidate politicians during the Brandon Tate Brown. I didn't see them during the Darren Manning. You know, the list goes on and on.
Have you been taking a lot of shit for being the pro-black guy backing the white candidate?
Not really. Because I think Larry has that crossover appeal where people, he's defended so many people in the hood pro bono, and he keeps those relationships that, he can walk up into the Abbotsford Projects and get that type of respect.
I have to ask, since we're talking about the DA's race, and you mentioned Tamayo McDuffie and Darren Manning early on, and just so our listeners are clear, Tamayo McDuffie was a 17-year-old teenager arrested, turned 18 in prison because his next door neighbor said he tried to blow up her home. He was charged with attempted murder. Mm-hmm. The DA's office had no physical evidence tying him to the case. You were part of the coalition that advocated for his release. Mm-hmm. A year went by. He was eventually released. Yes. His family went bankrupt trying to defend him. The DA's office never apologized.
Mm-hmm.
You also mentioned Darren Manning, who was an honor roll student at Mathematics Civic Science Charter School in North Philly. He was heading to a basketball game in North Philadelphia where he was stopped and frisked, and he claimed a white female officer squeezed his testicles so hard that they were erupted. So you've been protesting against the district attorney's office for at least 4 years.
Yes.
Are you relishing in what's happening to Seth Williams right now? How are you feeling about all that? Are you gleeful? Are you sad? Do you feel like he's embarrassed the race? Do you feel like he's embarrassed you? Where do you stand with that?
Well, I'm not happy when anybody, especially black, that are in those type of historic positions to be the first fail. I think we all voted for Seth because we wanted him to succeed. We wanted change.
Yeah, he was a progressive when he was running.
Well, he presented himself
right,
as progressive, and he wasn't, actually. He turned out to be...
regressive.
Exactly. and very anti-black. I mean, mm-hmm. anytime Michael Kor, attorney Michael Kor, calls you anti-black, I mean, really.
So just to end on a high note, you are going to be getting awards in the coming month. I think more than just one.
Yeah, this
I heard
two,
that you're getting Lucian.
Lucian Blackwell.
Congratulations.
Thank you very
much. That's a big award.
It's a very honor, and I'm extremely humble because I'm a huge fan of
Lucian
Blackwell.
The late husband of current councilman Janie Blackwell.
Right, but also was a congressman. Also was a congressman. And city council.
And city councilman. And just a strong black leader.
And a union leader and all that stuff.
And the people who've gotten that award are, you know, everyone from Alan Waller to some really strong. I mean, I had the pleasure of getting the award in 2014. Mm-hmm. So you're in a good company. And then you also get another
one. I didn't know you got that award.
I did. It's been years. I got it with Solomon Jones, who's a reporter here.
They gave Flood an award before they gave me.
I'm just messing with you.
I remember now. You told me. I remember. I was out of town.
Okay. But so just
because you got at City Hall, right?
I got at City Hall.
Yeah, I was out of. I remember now. I'm remembering.
So just tell us about the two awards that you're getting.
Well, one is both of them are for me. I'm very humble. You know, I don't do this to get any type of plaques or awards, but it's very good to be recognized, especially now where, and thank God for the creator and how the universe works, because I really needed that type of support and uplifting, because I'm human and words do hurt, honestly, it does. I try to dismiss it, but it does. But to get it under the Lucian Blackwell is an honor, and to have my brother Malik Aziz, who mm-hmm. called, mm-hmm. Who confirmed it for mm-hmm. me, you know, was really... him being a messenger, that really touched my heart, and his words of encouragement. But also the LGBTQ community is giving me that award. Pastor Jordan, thank you for the awards. I love it, and I love the people who have given it to me. But after the sermon is over, I'm out with that bullhorn and the members, and we kicking ass and shutting shit down.
Well, congratulations, basically.
Thank you so
congrats,
much. Man. Thanks, Malcolm.
Yeah, thanks
I appreciate
so much
it.
Being
thank
here
you.
On Pushback.
Yeah, this
thank you,
great.
Guys. I appreciate it. What's going on, Troy? I know you're in the background, but thanks to Troy, too. I just thank you guys for inviting me here and making this place a safe space again for me today. I feel really good vibes, and I'm ready to move forward. So remember, you can follow me on Twitter now, Asa Khalif, at Asa Khalif, or, of course, Facebook, Asa Khalif, and Black Lives Matter Movement, Pennsylvania chapter. Feel free to like our Facebook page and keep updated on some of the events that we have.
It's a great conversation, and I want to thank you guys for listening. Remember that you can subscribe to Pushback on iTunes, or you can follow Philadelphia Magazine at Philly Mag on Twitter and Philadelphia Magazine on Facebook, and on Twitter, 900AMWURD and 900AMWURD. On Facebook. And so there's more great episodes like this and great conversations to come. Stay tuned for the conversation. And so for Malcolm Burnley and myself, until next time, I'm Flood the Drummer, and I'm drumming for justice.